Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
If unhealthy behavior was normal in your home as a child, it will seem normal to you as an adult. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show, and I'm hoping that there are a bunch of y'all because I have a reel that's going viral. So what do you need to know? So an adult child is somebody who grew up in an alcoholic or dysfunctional family whose unresolved childhood pain is fucking up their life in adulthood. And yes, we curse here, folks. And this is where we talk about what the hell to do about it in a very raw and vulnerable and an appropriate level of self-deprecating humor. So you picked a good episode to hop in on because boy, do I have a damn treat coming your way. I have the damnedest of treats coming your way. Today, we are diving deep with Tim Fletcher. So Tim is a pastor turned drug and alcohol counselor turned YouTube sensation who is impacting the world in some really profound ways and is one of the monumental voices for the cause of complex trauma. This is such an important mission because there are so many damn people that have no clue that they endured complex trauma. I mean, I had no damn clue. I had always known my childhood had been, you know, less than ideal. I didn't consider that it was trauma because I thought that trauma had to, you know, be something really big. And I didn't think that it was having an impact on my life as an adult because I could talk about what happened to me during my childhood without getting upset. And it wasn't until I saw the symptoms of complex PTSD that I was really able to come to terms with the fact that, yeah, what you did experience was trauma. And there's just so many damn people out there who haven't figured this out yet, right? Who think that they are inherently flawed and unfixable, like so many of us felt before realizing that our problem was our unresolved childhood trauma. So I am super pumped for y'all to hear this interview. It's actually going to be a two-parter, so you get part one today. So let's just get the damn show on the road, okay? But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you, need to damn the join shit show. This is my online support community where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups. This is a support community, a lifeline at your fingertips, in your back pocket. There's an app with just some really fucking cool people. This is a place where you can just show up as yourself, as your shit show self, and be loved and supported as we go through this really difficult journey of healing this shit. So just do it. Damn the join. See the link in the show notes next. Give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Hey, leave me a review and say that you found the podcast because you found my reel. Actually, let's make this a contest, okay? So go and leave me a 5-star review on Apple. And then you can take a screenshot of it and DM it to me on Instagram at adultchildpod. And then I will pick 5 people who will win a mug or any accessory that they want. We got mugs, we got water bottles, we got hats, we got notebooks, we got iPhone cases. You take your pick. So yeah, leave me a damn 5-star review, send it to me on Instagram, and 5 of y'all will get some shit show merch, okay? Thank you. Love you all. The man, the myth, the legend.
Hello there.
I'm so pumped for this. I'm Andrea. That's the only way that you can mess up here is to call me Andrea or Andrea. That's the only way you can mess up here. Okay. Let's just rock and roll, dude. Well, first of all, so you were like, I have a community for adult children of alcoholic and dysfunctional families. It's called The Shit Show. And it really should be called the Tim Fletcher Fan Club. Oh. They're obsessed with you, man.
Wow.
Yeah, they love you so much. Every day they're posting videos and you should see the threads of everything that they're saying. It's really cool. You're having a huge impact on them.
Well, I tell people all the time that, like, when I started over 20 years ago, trauma and complex trauma weren't even terms yet. And so I started in the addiction field, the treatment center. And so we had adult ACOA, and then ACOD came out. And so that was really my initial kind of exposure to thinking about kind of there's common characteristics. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Janet Leutitz put out the book of 13 mm-hmm. characteristics. So that really got me started on what became the 60 characteristics of complex trauma. But when you start looking at characteristics, you go, okay, there's something deeper going on here that these are mm-hmm. symptoms of. And so that treatment center that I was in was the only one in Canada that saw addiction as a symptom of deeper problems and really began seeing it as people trying to medicate pain. And so where did this pain and emptiness come from? And I think ACOA and ACOD were on the same path. They were mm-hmm. just using a little bit different terminology. And when Dr. Gaber Maté came out with kind of saying, to him, it's trauma, that really started kind of focusing the field into there's something in childhood beyond just having alcoholic parents or being beyond just dysfunction. There's something more here that we can define better. And that really kind of was my journey in understanding that ACOA and ACOD to me are all aspects of complex trauma.
100%. I want to share a little bit about my story. I think it'll make for a better conversation. So at 9 years sober is when I really realized that I was an adult child. So it was after dating 2 alcoholics named Brian back to back. And it was through that I had always known that alcohol was just a symptom. But it was through that experience that I realized that my alcoholism was a symptom. And so through hitting that bottom in January of 2018, I found an amazing therapist, started working with her. And fast forward to March of 2021, I just started this podcast on the floor of my closet. So we're very much on the mission. Like I want to reach as many people as possible, especially those who are in recovery with, you know, multiple years under their belt, who can't figure out that they still have not yet dealt with the real cause of their alcoholism or addiction. So I just thought that would help provide some context for our conversation today.
It's a very familiar story, Andrea. I've heard it from thousands of people I've worked with I'm sober. So what's wrong now? Mm-hmm. Well, I still have problems. Like I thought my alcoholism was the problem and everything should be perfect after I fixed that.
So what I typically like to ask people first, my first question typically, and feel free to answer this or not, but was there a particular moment that you had where you really realized that your childhood impacted you a lot more than you initially thought it had?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I'll give you just a bit of my story, Andrea.
Please.
So I was raised actually in, I would say, a fairly healthy home, but there was a couple issues that I didn't even realize created trauma in me. Mm. So number one, it was very much work ethic home where you work. And so what came out of that was if you relax, you're being lazy or selfish. So I had no concept of healthy self-care, healthy boundaries around saying no to people. And then that blended with the second one, which was really a definition of love that was actually codependency. So if you're supposed to love people, but that means you sacrifice all your needs. You just give, and that's love. And so you become enmeshed in taking care of people. You never set boundaries with people because that would be cruel. That would be unkind. You never say no. And so those two things I was raised with that I thought was quite healthy, but actually it wasn't. And then the third was, I wasn't really given any other tools to deal with stress that came from the first two, other than dig a little deeper. And I like digging a little deeper because I was a high energy young boy, young man. I like to go. I loved 80-hour weeks. I thought 80-hour weeks made life exciting.
So you wouldn't have to feel or think anything?
Well, and looking back, I was actually always a very deep thinker and a deep feeler. Had a ton of energy that I wanted to use all the time. I got married, then I became a pastor of a church that was starting to grow. Then I had three young children within 5 years. So by the age of 32, I had this growing responsibility and stress happening in my life and zero tools to handle it. And so I just loved everybody. I worked constantly. Had children, never said no to anybody, didn't take care of myself, and 32 basically burned myself out. And that's when I began to realize was my parents weren't trying to abuse me or hurt me. They were trying to raise me well. They were actually doing some stuff that was setting me up to burn myself out and create my own complex trauma because I created this very unsafe environment for myself, whereas somebody else has this need, somebody else has this need, stress, and then mess myself up. So it was at that point that I entered really 7 hard years of my physical health broke down, deep depression, anxiety issues, that I began to realize something's very wrong here, and I got to figure it out. At the end of that I got asked to go into this to be an accountant, so I got my health stable after a few years and I was starting to heal. I didn't totally figure it out, but I got asked by a friend of mine who worked at this treatment center. And she said, we really need a male counselor. And I think you're the guy.
And did you have any experience with alcoholism or addiction at that point?
Very little, just a little bit as a counselor. They said, we train you everything. But my first response was, I think you got the wrong guy. Sorry, not interested. And about 6 months later, she came back and said, I think you really are the guy. Would you at least come to the interview? And went, and I said, oh, okay, I'll take they offered me the job. I said, I'll take it, but only 3-year probationary, because I don't know if this is where I'm.
3 years? That's kind of that's not a long time.
3 months.
Oh, 3 months. Yeah. Okay, I was going to say, that sounds like an adult child. I'm only giving you 3 years.
So I did it, and in the first week, I said, this is what I was cut out for, this is what I'm this. But I began to learn about myself as I was working in this field, beginning to understand these deeper issues, and I go, oh, I've got a lot of these. And I began to piece it all together, and it was really, for me, understanding kind of the subtle causes of complex trauma. So it's not always just abuse. It's that little T, neglect, bad teaching that can create trauma for ourselves. It was really kind of that turning point of me burning out. But then as I worked in this field, beginning to piece together trauma came from.
So for me, and I think for a lot of people, like I think it's best to kind of confront some of these issues until you kind of had the sobriety handled. But I think for other people, I think the reason that they're not able to accumulate any sort of time is because they like this stuff has to be, you know, confronted right away.
Exactly. Yeah. And to me, that's the challenge in the field I work with is I think at some point everybody's got it. If they're going to get healthy, they got to confront how their childhood shaped them. The problem is, where in their recovery do you confront it? Some have to do it right at the front end. Others, that's too soon. It's just going to cause them to relapse. They got to wait for a while and get some other tools in place and sobriety under their belt. Then they can confront it. And so that, to me, is the challenge as a good counselor, is to kind of know when it's the right time to bring it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, usually it presents itself, but exactly. I mean, I guess if somebody's a chronic relapse or they need to, but people are so resistant. Yeah. It's interesting. In the first couple of months of launching my podcast, I got Dr. Drew came on mine, and because I'm really the only one out of my close friends that I got sober with that have really hit this. And I have 15 years now that have really hit a hard second bottom. And, you know, I asked him, I'm like, do you think that everybody has this stuff? And he's like, yeah, everybody does. It's just for some people, it just might not ever get painful enough for them to have to deal with it.
I'd agree. Are you familiar with the stages of change?
So maybe. I don't know. Talk to me about it more.
Okay. So there's the pre-contemplation stage. I don't have a problem, but everybody else thinks I do. So you're not even contemplating changing. So that's denial. Contemplation, which is, yeah, I think I got some problems, but that really what's going on in your mind is I'm still getting benefits from my addiction, even though I'm starting to see some negative consequences. So I'm kind of on the fence. I'm ambivalent. I want to change, but I don't want to change, but I'm starting to at least contemplate it. Then you start to get to a point where there's more negatives than positives that come out of it. And so you start to go to preparation. I think I need to change. What I have to give up, what I have to add, what I have to change. And you're starting to be more realistic in weighing out what this change would look like, but you're not quite there till you kind of hit enough pain to go, action, I'm ready to change. I'm ready to do whatever it takes. So that's what they realize is for most people, that can take several years to get from pre-contemplation to action stage. What I teach clients is this. Most people come into recovery thinking, I'm going to go through the stages of change with addiction. And I go, yes, you are. But then you're going to hit stages of change around relationship stuff. Mm-hmm. That you keep falling into the same relationship patterns. You actually have a relationship issues, addiction. I go through it when it comes to dealing with some abandonment issues, then some shame issues. So you're going to go through the stages of change with every issue. And so you can get through your addiction, and then you could go for a year or two going, I need to change how I do relationships, but I'm so lonely. I so want a boyfriend. I think that's going to solve all my problems. And that's going to go stages of change for another couple of years to go, okay, I'm ready to change that, regardless of how painful. Then you're going to go to the next thing. And so it's a constant.
The onion.
What's that?
The onion.
Yeah, exactly. With each layer of the onion, you got to go through that decision to actually change. And there's stages that you're going through.
But a lot of people never
exactly get there. That's where, to me, you don't go through to action unless the pain gets bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just think about the people that kill themselves with like decades of sobriety, the people that have, here's my cat, the people that have, you know, decades of sobriety that are fucking miserable, you know?
Yeah. To me, doing this for over 20 years is that most of the people I deal with, they will grow to, they'll make a couple of changes and then it's like they hit a wall that I'm not willing to change anymore. And mm-hmm. it's never going to get painful enough to make me willing to want to change this. And so they just kind of stay stuck there for the rest of their life. Switches, they go up to the next layer of the onion, they're just not willing to. And usually there's a deep shame, fear type of issue that's keeping them from being willing to go there. And they can go through the rest of their life. And if they're fairly competent people and they're pretty good at social, superficial stuff, they can kind of coast for a lot of years without ever having to feel the need to really ever change. And it's so sad in a sense, but that's where so many people are.
As that goes on, does one have to, your like psychological defenses have to get stronger to avoid it?
Yeah. So to me, one of the challenges, and you look at your two relationships with Brian, mm-hmm. is we never remain sick at the same level. We're always getting sicker gradually. So the longer we stay in toxic relationships, the longer we stay in unhealthy coping mechanisms, they're only going to get a little worse, a little worse, a little worse. And so that then means greater denial. That means greater isolation, greater medication, greater distractions, greater getting my validation from all the wrong reason or wrong sources. But people have to get more extreme in their unhealthy coping as they get sicker. And for many, that's what happens. And they can do that for you.
So when you were working in that treatment center initially and in the beginning, how was, this was a residential?
Yes.
Like a 30-day residential. What were y'all doing at that point in time as far as like addressing this sort of stuff? Or was it not really then?
Yeah. So again, we were the only treatment center in Canada. I'm so thankful for this. That saw addiction as a symptom of deeper issues. And that to—
Where was this?
In Winnipeg, Canada. And that to the addict, their drugs and alcohol was actually the solution to some problem that they hadn't defined. And so the lady that mentored me had been in this field for 25 years. And she was really, I think, one of the pioneers in this whole complex trauma field, even though it didn't have a title yet. But she just said, Tim, it's a pain. It's pain from deep losses. It's a pain from emptiness, from needs not being met. So they asked me to begin preparing new workshops for their clients. And so I did a workshop on the 12 needs that weren't met in childhood. I did a workshop on shame, that poor identity that I'm not good enough. Then they had me start doing the characteristics of this pain in your life and this emptiness in your life. So it went from 25 characteristics to 30 to 50 to 60 today. So
60 is a little bunch.
It was just a gradual evolution for me of providing more material to help people understand it. And then Dr. Gabor Maté came out with trauma, and then complex or developmental trauma disorder came out, then complex trauma came out. And that just sent me on kind of Bessel van der Kolk's, Pete Walker, all every source I could to get more and more information. And just so, because I'm working with clients every day and getting their input and their questions and their feedback, just morph into kind of a greater understanding and more material.
Were there some real pivotal moments as far as like your understanding of this?
I just always think it's really kind of interesting that the very first book they gave me to read was, it was around addiction is trying to meet your needs, but with the wrong solution. Mm-hmm. And that sent me on this journey of understanding our needs, which led to the workshop on the 12 needs. So we got intellectual needs, physical needs, emotional needs, relational needs, spiritual needs. And so I began to develop that. And that to me was the pivotal thing. And then I began to realize that what is recovery? Well, it's learning to meet your 12 needs in a healthy way instead of meeting them in the old unhealthy ways that you had growing up. So food, sex, drugs, alcohol, whatever. So that to me was a really pivotal because it was so foundational and so much became built on that. And then the second piece to me, and it's again fascinating, the second workshop, my boss said, I want you to do a workshop on shame because I think there's this core identity, I'm not good enough. I see it in every client that we have. I want to figure out where it comes from and help them understand it. And at that time, there were two books on shame in existence.
Bradshaw was Healing the Shame That Binds You Out.
Oh, and I can't remember the name of the other one. So I went through them I created a workshop, and I was just blown away by most people couldn't even identify shame, though they were full of it. It was just like this hidden subconscious thing. Secondly, when people began to understand it, how it just changed their whole understanding of why they did what they did for years and why they went about relationships the way they did. And so that workshop to me became pivotal. And then what was fascinating to me is I began to develop the complex trauma perspective. is to see all the programs that were out there for CPTSD and how they dealt with kind of emotional dysregulation, flashbacks, all the stuff around trauma. But none of them were dealing with the shame or any debt. And I went, to me, it's a core.
That's the core of it.
Was done. Yeah. And so those two, I think, were the two pivotal pieces. And with that shame piece, to me, it was complex trauma ultimately leads a child to feel all alone. So there's an abandonment issue that it's me against a big bad world because either mom and dad are neglecting me, put me up into a child care, or they're abusing me. So that basically is they've abandoned me. So I just feel all alone in the world. And that abandonment piece, again, I wasn't seeing anybody else dealing with that. And so that really started to get a bit of clarity when kind of attachment theory started to come out. And then we saw how big attachment was for children. And that really addiction is trying to find the feelings of attachment without actually true attachment. Mm-hmm. I'm going to attach to a chemical because it gives me the same feelings. So that whole attachment, abandonment was just pivotal as well.
When you talk about the 12 needs, how does one determine when somebody is using substances to meet their needs? How do you tell? How do you describe that? Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? So Katherine Heigl, you know her from Grey's Anatomy, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says that she's seen more issues with dog joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to improve any dog's health: their food. So what she's discovered is that the way many dog foods are made can actually create toxins that could be wrecking our dog's health. But fortunately, she has found that by just adding a few special superfoods to her dog's food, she saw huge transformation in their health. And she has made a 20-minute video explaining step-by-step how anyone can do this same thing to see incredible changes in their dog's health. Now, y'all know I'm a cat lady. Y'all know that Kiki is the queen of the shit show here. But I watched this video and there's actually some things that I can apply to her health. So hopefully she'll live another 15 years or so. So go to badlandsfood.com/adultchild and watch Katherine's video. Again, that is badlandsfood.com/adultchild. All right, my shit show ladies, let me tell you about how I can make getting dressed so much easier for you. Armoire is a clothing rental membership where you get to build your perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you got to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and then select from your personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new to you styles. So I love this because I'm on video quite often on interviews and social media content. And I don't want people to be like, is that the only shirt that this girl owns? I also would not consider myself in the know of what's hot and what's not. But with Armoire, I get to pretend like I'm a fashionista. So this is perfect for working moms, for stay-at-home moms, for any women who just don't feel like going to the store. Now, right now, you shit show ladies can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off your first month. So that is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/adultchild. That is armoire.style, armoire.style/adultchild to get 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear ever again. Do you know how many times I have set the intention that on Sunday, I'm going to get up, I'm going to plan my meals out for the week, I'm going to go to the store, I'm going to get everything that I need, I'm going to come home, I'm going to make all my meals for the week. Do you know how many times I've actually been successful in doing that? Not once, folks, okay? Not one single time. But alas, I have found the perfect solution. Meet Sunbasket, a team of dietitians and chefs that design wholesome, nutritious, and delicious meal kits delivered to your damn door. You get to pick and choose what you're in the mood for every week. Maybe one week you're feeling Mediterranean, maybe another week you're feeling a little carb consciousness. I like the sound of that. I most recently made, it was a spinach and strawberry salad with steak. It was damn good. So go to sunbasket.com/adultchild today to save $120 across your first
four deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/adultchild to save $120 across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order.
Well, I would say to me, anybody that's using a substance is trying to meet a need. Usually is related to pain is what we kind of see on the radar. I'm feeling some pain, so I need some medication. I need a drug.
Well, what about someone going out to have a glass of wine at dinner? Like, would you consider that meeting a need? I mean, I've never done that before. I've never considered.
So take it this way. When I go out to eat food, I'm meeting a need. But I can also use food in unhealthy ways.
Yeah, yeah.
To try to meet other needs. So if I was in pain and crying as a child and grandma said, here's a cookie, that'll make you feel better. My brain got the wires crossed and all of a sudden is food meets sadness. It fixes sadness. Well, food wasn't designed to fix sadness. It was designed to fix physical hunger. But now in my brain, the wires are crossed that food also meets emotional needs. So now whenever I'm feeling stress, anxiety, sadness, let's eat, let's medicate with food, let's eat my emotions. The same can happen with, so any good thing, sex has a wonderful purpose, but now I can use sex whenever I'm lonely, whenever I'm sad. So I can take the good use of every need and misuse it. And wires get crossed in my brain. And now I'm trying to meet needs that it wasn't designed to meet. So to me, a person going out for wine, so alcohol, if you look at every culture, basically had a celebratory connection, but in moderation. It had a purpose. It wasn't meant to medicate pain. It wasn't meant to keep me totally numbed out. It was designed to enhance a celebration or a period. But for people that have pain, they discover alcohol and it makes them feel better and it medicates the pain and they go, I got the solution to my problems. And now they misuse it. That to me happens with most drugs, medication is it's misusing that to try to solve issues that it was never designed to solve. And usually if you look at most of that emptiness and pain, it's coming from a need but not being met. So when a need's not met, so if you take hunger or water, you then have a sensation of thirst or hunger. So if you didn't get the right amount of food or the right amount of water, you get hungry or thirsty. Same happens with emotional needs. If they're not met, you get an emotional hunger, you get an emotional thirst. It creates this hole in your heart, this emptiness that you now have this thirst for. But if you try to solve it with something that gives you brain chemicals that make you feel good, doesn't really meet that need, then your brain goes, if I have this sensation, then I use this. And now you set up the wrong equation in your brain.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the process of toxic shame for a child? Internalized shame?
Yeah, it's such an important question. Because when most people think of shame, they think of it in terms of emotion, that I feel ashamed of myself.
Yeah, or guilty. Yeah.
But that's really...
versus an identity.
Exactly. So they usually confuse guilt with shame. Mm-hmm. And it's really helping people understand that shame is actually a belief about myself. Mm-hmm. It can be an emotion, but primarily it's a belief. And so when you look at a child who's not being loved unconditionally, whose needs aren't being met, who's being neglected, who's being abused, in their brain, it's, I must be doing something wrong. It's my fault. So I must not be good enough. I must not be valuable. I must not be lovable. That's why dad's neglecting me. That's why dad's hitting me. It's me. And so all of a sudden, they are creating this self-identity that says, I'm the problem. I'm the bad one. So that's part one. Secondly, when you look at a child in a healthy home, parents make an important distinction for them. So if they do something that, let's say they hit their brother, their parents will say, that's a bad action, but you're
not your bad.
Exactly. Whereas in complex trauma, you do something bad, you're bad. And so your actions now get equated with your identity. And that's why guilt and shame get mixed up. So you did something bad, that makes you bad. So if you have guilt, that means you are a bad person, not your identity. So you're shame. And that gets all blended together in kind of the complex trauma world. And so what happens with that to me is most of that happens to a child even before they have words. And so it's happening in their subconscious brain. They're not even getting words or emotions for it. Their brain's just figuring it out and creating this identity based on that. So one other way, if I can just say it, a child gains their identity by basically, like when we think of figuring out our own physical identity, we look in mirrors, reflect back to us, this is what you look like. And so a child gains their psyche identity by looking in the mirrors of the significant people in their life. And that is based on how they treat them and what they say to them. And so if they're neglected or abused, then what's reflected back to them is you're a zero. You're not worth anything. You're bad. And so their mirrors are actually what is faulty, but the child thinks that they're faulty. But if you had distorted, faulty mirrors in your life every day, to you, they're telling you the truth. They're accurate mirrors. And then if you were to go to your friend's house when you're 15 and they have an accurate mirror and you see yourself totally as a different person, you're going to go, something's wrong with that mirror. Mm-hmm. And that's where people with shame, when they
take a compliment,
in a healthy relationship, they go, what's
boring.
What's their agenda?
Snooze fest.
Exactly. They have total ways of discounting anything that contradicts that initial distortive mirror. And that's therefore where they get drawn into unhealthy relationships, because they reflect the same thing that the mirrors of their child are
different. I can't relate. I'm sure somebody can. But this, I think this goes to speak to just how insidious this stuff can be. Because for me, for example, you're going to love to hear about my childhood, but before we get there, I was never told I was a piece of shit. You know, I was never verbally abused. That piece of like, I'm bad, for those that were very blatantly abused. Because we talk about that, the fantasy bond, right? And like, in order for us to survive, a child must ingrain that they can't think it's their parents. They need their parents to survive. And so it's much easier for the kid to say it's because of me. But when the stuff is so subtle, especially in your situation, I mean, mine was more blatant than yours, but like, we have no damn clue that we had. Like, I thought consciously that I had high self-esteem, that I had high self-worth, but clearly my actions in romantic relationships showed otherwise. And so that's why I just think the really subtle stuff, the subtle emotional neglect is so hard for people to comprehend how much they hate themselves or how inherently flawed they truly feel at their core.
Exactly. And that's why over the years I've developed like 70 questions that people can begin to get in touch with any shame that's way, way down there that they're not even aware of, but it's still kind of running their life because it's so subtle. It's so hard to put your finger on. And part of the problem with that is we live in a culture where people don't talk about shame. That's almost a new word in our vocabulary. It's a concept we don't even understand because it never gets explored or talked about. And so we have to develop a new language, a new way of helping people understand this concept that is so powerful, but yet so hidden and so subtle. So if I can add one other piece to this, Andrea, and it would be this.
You can do it. Anything you want.
I grew up with like, so my complex trauma was so subtle, but it took me a while to figure out what it was. But I always knew I had self-esteem issues and I didn't know where they came from. So what I've come to understand of working with people with shame is people that have shame tend to respond in two different ways. So some just acknowledge it, they don't deny it, and they just, yeah, I don't like myself, I'm a terrible person. And they kind of go to that negative self-concept and more almost like needy victim, hide in corners, try to be invisible, and they know what they're doing, but they do it. Whereas others try to compensate for it, and they try to convince themselves that they have great self-esteem, almost to the point that they feel a bit superior to everybody. So they overcompensate. Often they have to feel a bit superior to feel good about themselves. And so it's kind of two extremes that come out of shame. And so the people that go to the overcompensating, it takes them even longer to realize they have shame because they, for so many years, go, how can I have any shame? Look, I love myself. Look, I do all of this stuff. But then they begin to realize, like, why do these hidden forces still steer me in negative directions in relationships and set me up to fail in relationships and cause me to get triggered and go ballistic at times? What's that all about? Then they begin to get in touch with these hidden forces and they go, oh, that's shame. Oh, that's shame. Oh, that's shame. And it slowly starts to get pieced together for them.
What were some of those puzzle pieces for you?
I think so my wife, Kim, grew up in a home that on the surface, and they met all the physical needs. They had a wonderful life physically, and they lived in a family that was always having fun. And so on the outside, it looked like this wonderful family. Meanwhile, her father was a narcissist. And basically, they could only have fun if everybody agreed with him and conformed to what he wanted. So they all were raised to be more attuned to their dad and what his emotions were, to what he thought. They weren't aware of their own emotions or what they thought. They just had to be what their dad wanted them to be. And then they would have fun. And then life would be great. But what always was happening below the surface is they never felt seen. They never felt heard. They always felt like they were stupid and inferior, but they could never put words to that. They could never identify that because they were having fun. They were the happy family that everybody looked up to, and they felt superior to everybody. What happened to Kim was when my children began to call her on stuff, and she would go ballistic. Like, how dare you? You got to respect me. And she could not face kind of some of her own inadequacies, because that would be admitting she's less than, she's not good enough. That would be going to her shame and being the very thing she's been running from all her life. So that was very beginning of kind of helping her begin to realize that was when her children began to go, Mom, you're not easy to have a relationship with, and we're getting tired of trying to have a relationship with you because you always have to be right. You can never, and it's kind of whatever you want. So you're becoming your dad. And then this,
how old were they then?
Just coming into their teens. And then the second piece was, as long as everything was going smoothly, my wife could be the most wonderful person in the world. As soon as something went wrong where she felt disrespected, not seen, somebody was rolling their eyes, making her feel stupid, it's just like this different personality became out. And that
trauma response.
And that's when the damage got done. That's when things got said and actions got done impulsively that did damage. And then huge regrets afterwards. But it was like, what was that all about? And so it was really those trigger times where those ballistic responses happen that were kind of the doorway into starting to explore there's something deeper happening.
It happens in parenting. I mean, I'm curious, like, if that side of her only started to be exposed once you guys started having kids.
Yeah. And what I tell clients is, if you look at the wounds that produce shame, they're the ones that took place in intimate relationships, most intimate relationships in the world. And so what happens for many people coming into recovery is they go to treatment center, but they don't have any intimate relationships. They're just working.
Yeah, they're good. They're good.
And then if they do try to have an intimate relationship, they either relapse or they end it right away. That ghosts the person. And still they don't see the shame. They just think it was the relationship that was the problem. But it's when they actually get healthy enough to begin to go into intimate relationships and make them possibly start to work, that they find these deep triggers that they've never seen before. Mm-hmm. Then they go, what's that about? And I go, well, you're finally having this stuff from infancy and the intimate relationships there that are just starting to be re-triggered. So your deepest wounds were triggered by deep intimacy. And so they're not going to get, or were created by deep intimacy. So they're not going to get triggered unless you get into deep intimacy again. And that's usually children.
Yeah. And that kind of brings up an interesting point as far as somebody chooses just to not ever dip their toe in the pond again, like a relationship anorexia. It kind of avoids, in a way, they don't have to do that work. They never get to that place.
Yeah. And so I think, to me, there's a couple important pieces with that. What happens for many people with complex trauma who don't have attachment, who don't have that healthy intimacy, they kind of begin to isolate, build walls, wear masks, all of that, is what they don't realize is they stop intimacy with themselves. They actually disconnect with themselves. I don't like myself. I'm going to stay busy because I can't deal with the pain that I feel. I need constant numbing and distraction to live. And so living with themselves is actually one of the most unsatisfying, painful things that they could do. And so some of the people that realize I can't have intimate relationships, I'm not even interested, if they're able to build an intimate relationship with themselves, they're surprised at how satisfying that can be. And then secondly, for many people, their whole concept of intimacy always has romance as part of that equation. Mm-hmm. And what they have to realize is you can have deeply intimate relationships that don't have romance, and they can be extremely satisfying too. And so if people can begin to kind of realize there's actually three types of intimacy: with yourself, non-romantic, and then romantic, you can have the first two and have a very satisfying life. And so some realize that they can do that, and they do that. The ones that just go to kind of pure isolating, I don't need anybody, I don't want to get hurt again, often they have to numb a loneliness.
Yeah, I would think that ultimately it would start to show up in other ways.
And that's where they end up having other types of addictions often that can get them back into trouble.
How would you define having an intimate relationship with yourself? What does intimacy with self look like?
Well, part of it. So to me, what happens with complex trauma is various levels of dissociation. So a child is living with their needs not met. So they're feeling hurt. There's pain in that. There's a thirst that's developing that they can't satisfy. So they've got these painful emotions. They're feeling rejection. They're feeling hurt. They're feeling disrespected. They're feeling not loved. They're feeling it's not fair. All kinds of painful emotions. And they can't resolve any of them. Mm. They try, but it takes mom and dad to change to resolve it, and it's not being resolved. So they basically go, what do you do if you can't resolve pain? Well, I don't want to sit in it forever. So I either medicate it or I disconnect from it. I dissociate from it to some degree. So that's where people can escape to an academic world, to a fantasy world. They can numb out. They can just be busy all the time. But the key is they don't have the ability or desire to be present in the present, because the present is too painful. So I need to be out of the present somehow. And so I go to a fake fantasy world. I go to my head. I distract myself. And so the first step in learning to have a relationship with yourself is to be present to yourself. Learning to listen to your body, learning to pay attention to your emotions, learning to sit with your emotions instead of trying to escape your emotions, learning to develop healthy escapes and healthy hobbies, and to enjoy doing stuff that is pleasurable, that feeds your soul, learning to ask yourself questions, learning, for many people, learning to develop a relationship with little Andrea and know what little Andrea went through and begin to nurture her and comfort her. Exactly. All of that becomes that child part of the adult child. I have to have a relationship with them and bring them up to their adult years. so that I don't remain an adult child forever. All of that is such an important piece.
When you address complex trauma, what are like the core goals or components that you see as being part of the process?
Yeah. So first of all, because most complex trauma took place pre-verbal when the child was born, most of it is in your subconscious mind. So you created all these programs and templates of what your normal is, about how to live so you don't get hurt. So basically it was, if I'm authentic with people, I get judged. Well, therefore I never have intimacy. Well, that's a faulty program to operate your life on, because true intimacy only comes out of being authentic, whereas to a complex trauma child, authenticity never results in intimacy. And so you got to realize, I got some programs that operate that are based on lies, and I have to begin to understand those programs. So there's a huge self-awareness psychoeducational piece.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a huge dissociation piece of complex trauma. So I can't deal with all these painful emotions. I can't resolve them. So let's disconnect from my emotional world. Let's just become this super analytical and academic who lives in my head, or a super busy person, so I never have to feel. And so I have to reconnect to all of me and begin to enter that emotional world. And that's a scary place for most people, because they're pretty sure they're going to run into a lot of emotions that are painful, and they will. So that leads to the third thing. People need basic tools to regulate their emotions. And what happens for most people in complex trauma, well, every child can't regulate their emotions. They need a co-regulator. But if mom and dad aren't available, or if mom and dad are dysregulated themselves, then my co-regulator is actually dysregulating me more. And so I have to learn to self-soothe. My forms of self-soothing to try to regulate end up becoming unhealthy. I have to learn to regulate my emotions now in healthy ways, and learn what healthy self-soothing looks like. And that is so important, to get those basic tools before you start looking at the trauma, because you're going to stir up a lot of painful stuff. And if you're not able to start regulating some of that and grounding yourself, you're going to send yourself back into a relapse. We're going to do more harm than good. It's really some very basic primer kit of emotional regulation tools that we call gives agency to a client, begin looking at the trauma. And that then, to me, looking at the trauma, usually you need to do it with a professional, because to try to reprocess it just on your own often is too much. And what people don't realize is that when you reprocess it on your own, you're actually going back into your limbic brain, and you're seeing the world from the limbic brain's perspective, which is still the child's perspective. And so to the child, you still have the feelings of hopelessness and helplessness and being all alone. Nobody's there to support me. Nobody cares about me. So you're basically, your whole perspective is defeatist and negative, and I don't have tools. And so you overwhelm yourself. And that's why to reprocess trauma doesn't mean you just go back and walk through it again and go through the pain. No, it means you do it with a professional that helps you get the right perspective on it, and helps you realize this is what was really happening. It wasn't your fault. It was their fault. You were a victim, yes, but you aren't now today. You now have tools to change how you cope. So it's beginning to give them tools to reprocess it, and then knowing you need some help initially. Eventually you can do a lot of it on your own, but initially you do need some help to do that.
Yeah, and part of it too, do you think is, part of it is that is not just what happened to us, but the fact like that who we didn't have around us, like when it happened to us, and who we didn't have, like we didn't have that attunement. And so having somebody there to, yeah, like witness it with you and attune with you, validate you.
Yeah, so the issue is that every child has painful stuff happen to them, but not every child has trauma. So another way to say that is
you hear that, folks?
Every child has traumatic events happen to them, but they don't end up with trauma. So trauma is what happens in you when you don't have support and tools to deal with traumatic events
outside of you.
So if you have, yeah. So if you have support and tools to deal with traumatic events, then you don't end up with trauma. Trauma becomes this psyche wound, couldn't resolve the traumatic event. Why couldn't it resolve? Because nobody taught me tools and nobody supported me and walked with me through it. So it's very much dependent on what the child had externally as a child.
Have you, in your healing, done much parts work?
Oh, tons.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what I would say is a couple of things to that. So Richard Schwartz and Internal Family Systems, to me, has done tremendous work. And we would probably say that like inner child and internal family systems work is probably one of the best tools for our clients that we find.
Yeah.
That begins to help them realize that part of them had to kind of split off, or our personality had to develop to try to protect them as a child. So you get your firefighters and your managers that are, one's your limbic brain, one's your cortex, that are trying to keep that little child safe. But now their work is actually maladaptive. It is making life more difficult. And so what we just do tons of work with people, but two things that are, I think, important to say is that there's still almost a stigma around that kind of stuff, that that's for sissies, that's hooey-gooey stuff, like who needs that? And so it's getting past that to realize that this isn't gobbledygook. This isn't just psychobabble. There's some basis for that. So at least be willing to give it a bit of a try is what I do. Just don't discount it outright as being too weird or that's for sissies. The second piece is, in my own life, like, I do parts work, but I grew up in a very stoic family. So it had two characteristics, one healthy, one not healthy. So we could express all emotions, but not too bigly. But that was good. We could express all emotions. But the main way, when they got too big, we had to shut down expressing them. But what we learned was you talked about. And so that's why I put emotions into words. That's why I talk through what I'm feeling, whereas my wife expresses what she's feeling. So to me, there's a difference in how people express or deal with emotions. And it's okay to be different because both are healthy. I've had to learn to express emotions a little more bigger, but I still talk them through mainly. And my wife has learned to talk through emotions more. So it's realizing, okay, we all process stuff different. And so the same is true in my internal world. So my wife has on her desk all of her inner children lined up. I just have that in my mind. And I stop every once in a while in a week and go, what's little Tim feeling today? And I just get in touch with that, especially if I'm feeling a bit uneasy or discontent or restless, I stop and go, what's little Tim feeling? So I don't connect to my inner parts like on a daily regular basis, but I do regularly.
Check in, yeah.
And I do it more just as a check in and like, what are my needs right now? What's going on deep down? And sometimes I put it just in terms of what are my needs today. Sometimes I put it in terms of what does little Tim need today and what's he feeling. So I use different language to describe stuff, and parts work for me is quite good at times. Other times I don't bother using it, whereas other people really rely on it heavily. And that's
heavily, I was one of those people that thought, like, I knew that the inner child stuff was like legit, but I just thought it was corny as hell. But I knew that it was like, I knew that it was important. And it took me until it's probably about a year and a half ago where I really was able to start leaning into it. But people in my community, IFS has been so impactful to so many people within my community. And so I slowly kind of bought into that because that shit seemed a little weird to me too. I thought it was like some multiple personality crap, right? But, you know, I have been trying to work through some self-sabotage, procrastination issues for quite a while. And I feel like I'm not really getting anywhere. And what's been so interesting is like initially kind of like treating that from an inner child perspective. Like, let's say the feeling of panic comes up and I go immediately to like soothing. I know that you feel this way. Like I feel you, I see you, I acknowledge you, and then like comforting. But I don't think that I really was understanding. I'm not gathering the information. I'm not like, I don't actually understand the purpose. Like, what do they think I'm protecting me from? Because I think a lot of the times it's not rational, right? Because it's rooted in a childlike self. Mm-hmm. And so it's been really amazing to now, well, one, when that panic feeling comes up, to actually be able to finally recognize it and feel it as a part and that it's not all of me has been so freeing. But to not just go to soothe, I see you, I'm here, don't worry. To really just be like, what is going on here? You know, to really just like, I acknowledge you. I feel your presence. Like, what, you know, what do you need to tell me? And so I'm really hopeful, Tim, that I'm going to get somewhere. I just started doing the IFS work, but yeah.
That you're mentioning, I just want to highlight. Mm-hmm. What happens for most people when they look at kind of old ways of coping, so procrastination, is immediately we attach a judgment, and it's self-judgment, and I'm a terrible person. And then we try to defeat it with cognitive, you should do this, you're better than that. Just organize, just get a to-do list, blah, blah, blah. And it doesn't work. And it's because we're trying to solve it top down in our brain with the cortex. This is a bottom up. This is a child still influencing me, my limbic brain. And so I have to go there. So I got to go to self-compassion and realize that child was just trying to survive. And so they procrastinated to avoid failure, to avoid getting laughed at, to avoid getting hurt again. They avoided stuff because nobody ever taught them tools. They had different reasons for them procrastinating. So okay, I need to get in touch with what was that little child? What was me trying to protect me from by procrastinating, and then explore, begin to learn. So that's that compassion and exploration piece
the curiosity.
Yeah, curiosity.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. And it is amazing how freeing it feels to not feel like that part is all of me. Especially that panic. And it's like, and in a session the other day, it was like, that's the only way that I could get noticed, like, was through that panicked feeling. So I'm pumped about it. Let it all go.